Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday the 1st of October 2012. Tony Gosling. Well, Bristol's first podcast Dialect is back at our new Friday afternoon 2pm slot. This week, the first squatters in Britain ever went to jail last week for being homeless and daring to do something about it. So this week we hear about how squatting law has changed and ask once more, how could it be a crime to be homeless? Plus, a trip up to Filton to hear from one of the historic airport's best respected aircraft engineers. John Hart did his apprenticeship at de Havilland's many moons ago, now spends his time in Filton's aerial museum hangar, keeping vintage aircraft such as Spitfires in the air and even rebuilding them from scratch. John tells us what he thinks too of BAE Systems' plan to close the airfield permanently at the end of the year. And as we start Drones Week, Bob Nichols from Bristol Against the Arms Trade joins us as we look at the ethics of drones in the balance, with the profits coming to Bristol from their production. And also we have the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM at 93.2 every Friday afternoon at 2pm. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline is aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753. We'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. But first, squatting. And the first squatters in Britain ever went to jail last week for being homeless and daring to do something about it. This week we hear about squatting law. And I'm joined by Simon Jones, who lives at Pembroke Road in Clifton. And hi, Simon. Tell us, first of all, many of us haven't even necessarily met squatters. What first got you into squatting?
From being evicted from a shared house I was living in.
And how did that happen?
The landlord changed the house from us having a short-haul tenancy into holiday lets, so he could make more money from it.
But why hadn't you? Landlords do have to give you notice, don't they? And surely you'd have had a couple of months to find somewhere else.
He did. He gave us a month's notice. I moved in with a friend. I moved into a friend's house. She subsequently lost her job through some of the austerity cutbacks to the public services and got relocated to London. I was just sharing bills with her. She wasn't charging me any rent. She moved to London. I had to move out and has been homeless since.
But, everyone else pretty much pays rent, don't they? Why don't you think you should?
I'm not sure everybody else does. I think there are more people than what you imagine are squatting. There are a lot more people that are couch surfing. It's not so quite clear cut.
Well, I know, and I suppose the other thing is that there's quite a lot of people who've either been given homes by their parents or else have bought their homes outright. They're not actually paying rent, are they? So not everyone actually, I suppose, does, although we think that they do. There's very much a lot of controversy about actually how much rent costs as well. We don't have adequate housing. Bristol's got various estimates, somewhere between 14,500 and 19,000 people registered as homeless in the city. So you're originally squatted out of necessity. What are your thoughts about the politics of it and what the way that the system is actually addressing housing in Bristol and in Britain?
The system isn't addressing the housing issues that people have. The system seems to be addressing a for-profit motive on behalf of more wealthy landowners. We see this, I think, with the planning law changes to make it easier for developers to build
Also, what exactly is the law, and how did you? I mean, obviously, first of all, you've got to find yourself a squat. You realise you've got nowhere to stay. Where was your first squat, and what was that like?
My first squat was in a block of flats. It was a block of flats in a house, and several of the flats were squatted.
Okay, and so it was another squat, an existing squat that you moved into, was it?
Yes, it was.
And how does that work? I mean, because the thing is, because it's actually nobody's actually paying the rent for this particular place, isn't there a sort of a little bit of a fight about who's in there and who's not in there, who's in charge and who's not?
There were some quite mature people in this particular squat, and there were ground rules and. It was quite mature.
Okay, so, I mean, you're in a situation where you didn't have to break in, and that is the law. If you do break in, you're causing criminal damage, and you can be arrested. But if you're not breaking in, then there's actually no problem. Legally, supposedly, you're allowed to stay there. How has the squatting law changed over the last few months? Because, you know, I know you've been keeping your head around this. What is the big change?
They've criminalise squatting in residential buildings. They've included a new definition of residential. Anything that was or is designed or adapted to live in prior to squatting it.
Now, in your experience, you've squatted residential places. How long were they empty before you'd squatted them?
The flats in the block I was, they were empty for some of them for about a year.
Okay, and I mean, this is one of the things we hear quite a lot is that people going away on holiday, they come back and they find their home's been squatted.
No squatter in their right mind would go in to someone's home. Well, even before the law change came in on September the 1st, it was illegal. There was the Protected Intended Occupier law and the Displaced Residential Occupier. The police had powers to go in and arrest people that if you went out and brought a pint of milk or went on holiday or if you went away for 6 months and came back, if you could show you were living there, the squatters would get arrested.
So you say squatters in their right mind, but a lot of squatters are actually quite vulnerable people. Not all of them are in their right mind.
This is true, yes.
Yeah, so you know, how is there any sort of, you know, ethical code or whatever with squatting? Would you always make sure that there is, when you go in and have a look at somewhere new, that, for example, that there isn't furniture and people's personal items everywhere?
Well, I think the routes to homelessness are quite complex and very individualised. We were talking about squatting. Yes, if I go into a building and I see people's personal possessions there, I'm not going to go in there.
Okay. Ideally, you know, everyone should be being housed. I think it's probably fair to say back in the 1970s and 80s, it was really, you know, there was enough local authority houses being built, actually not the 80s, the 70s, to house pretty much everyone. What do you think are the sort of social effects of having this big housing shortage? I mean, like I say, in Bristol here, something between 14,500 and 19,000 people on the housing list. I mean, that means people sort of sofa surfing, people who got not enough bedrooms, maybe three or four children all in the same bedroom, this kind of thing.
It's driving rents up.
Well, it's good for the landlords then.
If you're a buy-to-let landlord, or yeah, a large corporation that's renting out. It's very good news.
What about this place where you are at the moment? I understand you're in Pembroke Road in Clifton. Now, that sounds like, you know, squatters in Clifton. It sounds a bit like that mansion squat that was in the news earlier in the year, with a lot of the Occupy Bristol people went to. Now, one of the, I don't know if it's spin or not, maybe you can tell me, but are squatters going up market?
We have recently. Prior to the place in Clifton, we were living in a light industrial unit that had been abandoned for 8 years, had a leaking roof. So, for us, the new place is going up market. It's commercial premises. It's leased by Lloyds TSB private banking firm.
Actually, Lloyds is part owned by the taxpayer, isn't it?
Some 46-odd%.
Okay, so, yes. Yeah, it's mainly private, yeah. And so what's that? I mean, surely, you know, you've got a leaking roof, really. I mean, how can you live like that?
The previous light industrial place we're in, the landlord was okay with us being in there.
Now, that's interesting because, I mean, I would have thought most of the time you're going to be in conflict with your landlord. How does that happen? And sometimes the landlord says, well, actually, I don't mind you staying there.
They were waiting for a planning application to develop.
Okay, so how what kind of permission have you got to be there? Well, they said that you can stay there for a couple of months, or how does that work when you're negotiating with the landlord?
Sometimes you get a licence from a landlord. Sometimes it's in the landlord's interest. If they have an empty building, they deteriorate over time. So in these situations, you can also provide some assurance that you're not going to be causing a nuisance or annoyance to the neighbours, you're not going to be detrimental to the structure of the building, you're not going to be scrapping anything. I found some landlords have been very reasonable and have given licence.
Well, Simon, I have to say, I mean, you seem like a very normal chap to me. You don't seem like some sort of drug addict or someone that's going to smash the place up. We'll hear a little bit more in a minute about the law in squatting, and if you find yourself homeless, Simon will have a little bit of advice of what the law is and what you can and what you can't squat.
Money.
Well, Money Talks there, and that is The Adventures of Stevie V from the, I reckon that was about 1990. I'm not sure if Simon's an expert on music. Simon Jones is joining me, who's a Clifton squatter. Simon, any idea when that, what year that was? I reckon about 1990.
Early 19 sounds good.
Okay. Yeah. Now, tell us a bit about the law. If, you know, if I find myself homeless, I find an empty building, the doors sort of ajar or whatever, and I need to bed down in there, what are my rights as a squatter?
If it's a non-residential building and you can just walk straight in, it's not a criminal offence.
Silly thing is if it's if it is actually designed as a residential building and it's empty, and I can think of quite a lot of places around the city where, I mean, for example, on the South Bristol site, there's about 90 flats empty there, which have been empty for a long time. It seems a bit illogical to say, well, you can sleep in a warehouse or you can sleep in a derelict swimming pool, but you can't sleep in an empty house. You know, seems a bit strange.
Well, When Ken Clark, the Justice Ministry, was pushing this legislation through last summer, they were trying to include commercial properties in the legal aid sentencing punishment of offenders bill. But because of pressure, they dropped including commercial properties. So they just stuck with residential.
So what was that? Where was that, the House of Lords or the Commons that altered that part of the bill?
The new anti-residential squat law, section 144, was tacked on to the back of the legal aid sentencing punishment of offenders bill. Right at the last stage, going through the Houses of Parliament, it got no reading, no debate amongst MPs. When it went through debates in the House of Lords, it was always tabled after 12 o'clock. So there was.
I can remember one night actually listening to the discussions at midnight, and there were only a handful of Lords left in the chamber. So this is very important legislation. I mean, you know, to remind people, this is never before in Britain has it been a crime to go into a building which has a door open in it and sleep there and take occupation of it if it's empty. And this is the first time in history that's happened.
Yes, it raises a number of legal issues, one of which is the retroactivity.
Hang on, what do you mean by that?
Okay. It means the law came in on September the 1st. If you were squatting in a residential building before that time, it criminalised you. It was retroactive.
Oh, okay. So you could be squatting perfectly legally, say, for example, in August. Then suddenly what you were doing becomes a crime and you can be arrested for it.
There's a mother of four children up in Wales that has been in a squatting a council house for the last 10 years, and this law now makes her a criminal.
I'm just thinking practically, though, if anyone finds themselves in this situation, so if you're in a commercial building, the owner of the property has to go to a court, to a civil court. They have to prove that they are the owner of the building, for example, take along the deeds, etc., order to get you out. What are your rights to do with things like electricity, gas, water, things like that? Because obviously, you know, number one thing is you need is water, but what about that and the others?
You can set up accounts with the utility companies. It's in the utility company's interest to set you up an account so you can.
Oh, okay. So have you been in squats then, where you've been squatting a building, not paying any rent, but paying bills like gas, electricity, water, that sort
yes.
of thing?
Yes.
Okay. For how long?
A number of months.
Yeah, okay. All right. Where, I mean, for someone that finds themselves in this position, and I think, you know, we're in a very difficult financial situation in the moment. I mean, if we look at what's happening in other parts of Europe, there are more and more people losing their jobs there. The same is true here. There's a massive cutback in benefits, you know, which is, you know, another aspect of this is it's driving people into working for organised criminals, but that's another side of it. But if people decide they don't want to work for organised crime and they do want to, sort of stick to the straight and narrow and find themselves having to house themselves, where is a good place, or where are good places and books and things to get hold of to find out what your law, what the law is on squatting and what your rights are?
You can get some very good legal advice from the Advisory Service for Squatters. They have a website, and they have office in London. and a phone line. Ah, there is the Squatter's Handbook. That's a very good practical guide on how to set up squats, how to do repairs, and how to deal with the legal aspects.
On the Advisory Service for Squatters, their website is www.squatter.org.uk. They're based at Angel Alley, 84B, Whitechapel High Street, London East 1, 7QX. And their phone number is 0203 216 0099. That's 0203 216 0099. Right. Just before we leave you, Simon, what advice have you got, just in a nutshell, for people in Bristol and in the surrounding area, if they are in the situation where they find themselves suddenly homeless or unexpectedly homeless? Is there any place they can come to in order to get advice?
Am I assuming that people have gone down the official routes of asking for debt advice, going to the council, and they've, as a lot of people, come against a blank wall?
Well, that happens often, but I mean, I suppose the first point of call is the city council, because there are some people who the city council have to house in bed and breakfast. But if they then refuse to do that, or that for whatever reason you're not eligible for that, what else?
If you're a young person under 25 that is going to be denied housing benefit with the new legislation coming soon, any number of people in situations like that, don't be afraid to talk to people about your situation.
I'll just give the number again for the Advisory Service for Squatters in London, who can supply you with things like the Squatter's Handbook, this kind of thing, and just general advice. That's 0203 216 0099. And there is, of course, a squatters group in Bristol too, which is called the Bristol Housing Action Movement. Anyway, Simon Jones from Pembroke Road in Clifton, squatting, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, to Filton Airfield, which is owned by the privatised defence firm BAE Systems, and where one hangar over near the police helicopter is home to one of the historic airport's best respected aircraft engineers. John Hart did his apprenticeship at de Havilland's and now spends his time in Filton's Aerial Museum hangar, keeping vintage aircraft such as Spitfires in the air and even rebuilding them from scratch.
My name's John Hart. I'm the chief engineer of the Aerial Museum. We look after and rebuild vintage airplanes. Amongst those, Spitfires and the Mustangs are our principal aircraft.
Even though this is now a sort of little independent business, originally you were part of Rolls-Royce. Can you explain what happened there?
Yes, I worked for Rolls-Royce for 38 years. When I came from Hatfield as an apprentice there, one of the last of the de Havilland apprentices, I came to this area, joined Rolls-Royce in their flight shed, saw some of the most magnificent pieces of engineering being made in their hangars. We had the Vulcan. We had very, very clever craftsmen, and they produced an engine to go underneath the Vulcan for Concorde, complete with its own fuel system and everything, and did a lot of testing. And then at a later date, we also grafted half a Tornado under the bottom of the airplane as well, including its gun, so that we could do all the checks for the shockwave that the gun would produce, just from drawings, and then we would manufacture the parts. And the skilled people that we had there could manufacture from those drawings equipment to be able to do testing, and eventually, obviously, make a lot of money for the industry. Rolls-Royce, although it had a communications flight of various aeroplanes, we had 5125s and BAC-111 and Gulfstreams and so on, we also had military aeroplanes, which we did a lot of testing and producing engines for them. In addition to that, we had the Rolls-Royce Spitfire. And then when I became a supervisor, it used to be one of my projects. Although it was based at East Midlands, during the season, it used to fly down to us every winter, and then we used to do all the mechanical overhauling and so of it. And that's when my interests really started to come from. And then as the years went by, I then rebuilt a Mark 8 Spitfire, which was privately owned, which took me nearly 14 years with a couple of other lads. And we got that flying, and it was a unique aeroplane. There's only two in the world that are flying. That aeroplane has been flying for the last 16 years. Rolls-Royce decided to centre its vintage aeroplane up at East Midlands. And so at the beginning of this year, in February, they decided to disband the area here at the 501 and move all their equipment up there and their aeroplane parts. To all intents and purposes, we were going to be finished. But what we've done is the private owners that we deal with have supported us. And although we look after some civilian aeroplanes like the 125 and so on, we're also looking after their vintage aeroplanes, including the Mustang. We're now embarking on rebuilding a couple of Spitfires. Once they'd moved, they had no interest in this area. We obviously still need to be able to continue our work. So I ended up getting the private individuals that own some of these military vintage aeroplanes and a guy who also owns a civilian 125. And they have supported us by paying for the rent of the hangar, so we can continue the work with them.
How on earth do you actually manufacture the bits that were being produced in the Second World War? Say, for example, for a Spitfire, you're going to have to make that from scratch.
Yeah, well, the Civil Aviation Authority make you have standards, and so I have to have what they call an M5 approval under A820, which gives me permission to be able to maintain these aeroplanes. If you want to then rebuild these aeroplanes, you have to have what they call an E4, which includes design, and under that, we then are allowed to manufacture parts. We have a large number of drawings here for most of the parts for the aeroplane, and so we can actually manufacture those parts to the original drawings.
Oh, so you've got a library of drawings, and then if you need to make something, you go back to some original drawings for what you used to design Spitfires?
Yes. The drawings are fairly easily available from Hendon. They've got a huge collection of about 8,000 drawings for all the various models. And if you use those drawings and you use the equivalent materials, because in some cases the materials have been superseded, if you use the equivalent materials, the CAA are quite happy for you to reproduce to the drawing.
And then you've got all the tooling here to do that. What kind of equipment do you have?
Well, the tooling is fairly basic. The skill level has to be fairly high to make the parts. They were very skilled workforces originally. And some of the specialist equipment that we don't have, for instance, for getting parts wheeled, which means, you know, where they curve the material in two directions, there are specialists around who can do this. Most of them are pretty old, but we can still get this work done.
Now, I noticed behind me you've got two wheels and undercarriage for a Spitfire. To what extent do you actually buy that in from the bits from somewhere, and what extent are you actually manufacturing it here at Filton?
Well, the parts originally were on the aeroplane, so those parts have been overhauled. The overhauling of them, we've got manuals, and the manuals tell you all the tolerances and how to repair them. So as long as you follow the instructions of the manufacturer, the Civil Aviation Authority are quite happy to let you continue to do that and make them airworthy.
So is there actually still a business in Britain in actually keeping these older planes going? I imagine there is, because, you know, what with all these bankers' bonuses, there must be people buying these old warbirds.
Yeah, there are quite a large number of people interested in these aeroplanes who've got large amounts of money, and, you know, they do spend quite a large amount of money on having them done. There is quite a cottage industry going on producing all these parts, and there are some quite notable companies making large parts. I mean, if you've got enough money, you can go to Airframe Assemblies, for instance, on the Isle of Wight, and they will produce you any part that you want, including wings, tail, fuselage, to drawing.
Well, that's good to know. Do you do sort of almost like an MOT type thing for a Spitfire here?
Yes, we do. We can do the, as you say, an MOT, it's a maintenance schedule, and it's basically you carry out all the maintenance of the aeroplane, look for things that wear on them, and there's routine stuff you have to do. And yes, we have occupied, and well, this hangar has been running now for 16 years with these aeroplanes, and we haven't had, touch wood, any problems with them at all. And we've had several Spitfires operating at the same time here, along with the Mustang. And so the local Civil Aviation Authority office at Weston-super-Mare are quite happy with our operation.
So what is it like actually trying to fix up one of these older planes compared to the modern ones? I mean, what are the big differences?
Well, the airplanes, first of all, if you look at the Spitfire, was originally designed in war to be actually operated for 100 hours. So when you start looking at that, they are very, very well engineered, I'm glad to say. When you compare them with, say, German airplanes, which are a lot simpler, a lot easier to construct, and still as fast.
When you say for 100 hours, do you mean before it got shot down?
Yes, that was its intended life in action. So you'd think by that some of the stuff wouldn't last much more than 100 hours, but we've got airplanes that have done over 2,000 hours, and they're still in good order. They were beautifully made, and they were over-engineered.
What about the guns? Do they still work on the Spitfires?
No, you've got to have deactivated guns. You're not allowed to go around with live guns on them. A couple of American ones that are owned by Mr. Microsoft have got guns that work on them. He's got an ME-109 that's got guns that all work, and he's also got a Spitfire and a Hurricane that also have all the guns that work.
What about other activities here on the airfield? Because as you drive past the new road that's being built, you can see that massive Brabazon hangar, which was built back, I imagine, in the late 40s, early 50s. Surely there are airlines and people like that around the world, maintenance companies, etc., that have got a use for a big hangar like that. I mean, how big actually is it?
The hangar is massive. You can put in the three bays a total of, I believe, 6 747s, and you can get 4 in the centre bay. The previous people to rent that area were MK, and they flew nothing but 747s and DC-9s. It's a very large area. It's very attractive to several large companies that I've been told about. The big problem is that they want a lease longer than BAE Systems are prepared to give them.
Well, that's a pity, isn't it? Because that could be actually a massive earner for Filton.
It could be, because the firm that used to do painting in the End Bay used to bring large aeroplanes in to paint them, and I know that the revenue from their landings alone was quite colossal.
What about the smaller planes, though? I mean, you've got a twin-engine Piper in here, so there must be a bit of private flying going on. Now, I know there's no actual flying club based here. What about people who are just enthusiasts and want to keep their hours up and do a little bit of private flying in a little single-engine Cessna or something?
There are private aeroplanes still here. They're diminishing rapidly with the demise of no weekend flying. The club that is still operating here is only the Bauer Club, which have got a couple of aeroplanes, and they're part of the Bristol and Rolls-Royce welfare department. But Aeros have recently left, who were quite a big operator. Again, the weekend thing has killed that for them.
Well, that seems bizarre, because obviously for people who are doing a little bit of flying in their spare time, the weekend is the obvious time to do it. I mean, for example, any airfields that do gliding, you always see them packed at the weekend with people who've got day jobs.
Dare I say they've been encouraged to go. They have been told basically that the weekend is not viable to run from this airfield. They've been, in a way, encouraged to move on to other places, which are thriving.
Do you think that if there was a little bit of, for example, open at weekends and a little bit more long-term thinking from the owners, BAE Systems, that it could be a successful airfield up here? Because it seems that they're limiting the amount of activity that can go on. We just talked about the flying clubs, but also with the massive companies that would bring in six-figure sums in rent and that kind of thing, because they're saying to them that they can't have a long-term lease. And obviously, for a firm to move here, they need to know that they're going to be able to be here for a while.
Yeah, I understand that some of the companies that want to come here have offered quite good deals. I only know of a couple of them, including the chap who owns the Dyson Empire. I know that he's made offers to support and make buildings and so on, but the company, BAE Systems, don't want to encourage anything more than a year, I believe.
Well, many people don't realise, but there's actually a regular scheduled services actually leaving Filton for Airbus. Now, it does bother me that if the airfield closes, how on earth are Airbus going to move their people around Europe? And the people are moving around daily. I mean, they have flights every morning.
BMI and their airplanes fly out of here daily. There obviously is going to be difficulties for them to fly their people, because they'll end up having to get on a bus and then take them to Lulsgate or somewhere, I assume, and then fly them from there. There's going to be obviously some time changes, because to go from here in the morning by bus up to Lulsgate could take quite a long time, and I should think that it would shorten the day for somebody who was trying to work over in Toulouse, say, for the day at a meeting and then come back again, because they'll have to be bussed back here again from Lulsgate in the evening.
Now, one of the things that they're saying is that this won't affect Airbus, because they can still continue to manufacture their bits and pieces here and simply move them around by road. But, I mean, if you look at other places like Hatfield, what's happened at Hatfield and how does that inform what may happen here?
The problem with Hatfield was that it was a large company. The whole of the town relied on all the infrastructure that went into supporting everybody with that company. There is a large college there, a university there. And because the airfield now has shut and BAE Systems basically closed the area down, the town has actually withered and it's just become a large area of bedsits. The galleries that was put up there, which was a large entertainment centre and so on, most of it's for let, and the place is very run down. The housing has all lost its value. It's a shadow of what it was.
One of the things that's really quite surprising about Filton and the surrounding area is that many of the local residents, it seems, actually want an airfield. Most people say, well, having an airfield near you is a complete nightmare. So why is that?
Well, I think initially, before they actually realised quite what was going on, they made a lot of noise about the aeroplanes and the flying and so on. But I think now that they've seen maybe a little of what's to come, of the two options, they possibly may be deciding that they'd rather have the airfield than the option of looking out over a large housing estate.
But going back to the old warbirds, you're in a situation where you're looking after some of these really ancient aircraft. What are you going to do, and what is going to happen with all your skills looking after, I mean, really unique skills, looking after these planes, some of which may be 60, 70 years old?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to all of it. All I can say is that if they do close the airfield, which is very likely, then we're going to have to look for another airfield to go to. There's several around here which are thriving, although BAE Systems are having a problem making this place pay, so they say. Everywhere else is thriving. We'll have to contemplate moving the whole operation.
Some people saying that it's not viable, other people saying that Filton is viable as it stands. What's your view on that?
Well, obviously, I don't know how much they make here or anything, because I'm not privy to any of that sort of information. But I do know that at the public meeting in Yate, they were saying that the company actually made a profit on this airfield of about 1.2 million. So somebody was saying it was in the paper. And that's without weekend work and without anybody being encouraged to stay here.
But ultimately, this is a decision for BAE, isn't it? I mean, if they can make more money selling it off for housing, surely that's bound to happen.
Well, it's happened on plenty of other sites, and there's another site up at Woodford at the moment which is going through exactly the same things, where they're trying to sell that also for housing. If you're talking to people about operating an airfield, keeping people busy and people working and an industry here, then it's a good thing. If you're looking at an account sheet and you're just basically looking to make some quick money to appease your shareholders, then you're probably going to try and sell it.
And what's going to happen if it all gets covered with housing?
I don't know where these people are going to get the money from to be able to buy these houses when there's nowhere to be employed. I also think that if the number of houses in this area actually are built, I don't know how anybody's going to be able to move their cars around this area, because it's pretty gridlocked anyway at going home time. And that's why British Aerospace, Rolls-Royce and the Ministry have got different shutting times in the evenings to try and alleviate some of this traffic. If you've got 3,500 houses here, plus whatever was on the North Field is going to be built, I think the place is going to be pandemonium.
That was vintage aero engineer John Hart there from the Aerial Museum up at Filton. And now, Jeff Sparks' What's On Guide from Dialect, starting with Friday, October the 5th, the Led Zeppelin tribute act, Whole Lotta Lead, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on the 5th of October, Ruckus Collective will be performing with support from Poor Old Dogs and One State at the Croft in Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets £4 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present The Doors. This group formed in 1965 and split up in 1973. In their career, they have released 6 albums with Jim Morrison and 3 albums after his death. This is from the album LA Woman, which was the 6th and last album recorded with Jim Morrison. And the song is Love Her Madly.
Don't you love her badly? Or don't you need her badly? Don't you love her ways? Or tell me what you say. Don't you love her badly? Wanna be her daddy? Or don't you love her face? Don't you love her as she's walking out the door? Like she did 1,000 times before. Don't you love her ways? Now tell me what you say. Don't you love her as she's walking out the door? All your love, all your love, all your love.
From 1971, Jim Morrison and the Doors from an album LA Woman. And just a little anecdote, Jim Morrison's father, Admiral Morrison, was the commander of the United States fleet at the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was a pretend attack. They didn't actually really get attacked at all. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, which started the Vietnam War back in the 1960s. So that was The Doors with Love Her Madly from the album LA Woman, and that was released in 1971. Moving on to Saturday, the 6th of October, Julian Cope will be performing with support from Urthona at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £19.50 in advance. Finally, on Sunday the 7th of October, Mike Willock's Fortet will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Bristol. Community FM 93.2.
Now, as we start Drones Week, Bob Nichols is here from Bristol Against the Arms Trade. Bob, hi and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, drones. I mean, we hear a lot about them in the news at the moment. This seems to be the sort of replacement, doesn't it, from Guantanamo Bay. Rather than illegally arresting people, sort of as captives, shipping them across the world using this extraordinary rendition system and putting them in a secret prison. Now, people have the pleasure of being zapped by drones instead, because it's a lot easier to deal with and there's no prisons and it's a little less embarrassing, no flights around the world. Drones seem to be the new click and kill method. So what about the first of all the legalities on that? Is it, I mean, are you a criminal if you sit at a computer screen and kill someone halfway across the world?
Wars have certain international guidelines and they're sort of enshrined in sort of Geneva Convention. So it's a sort of, which then, and they're mainly set up to protect civilians really, and to stop the, it's an acceptance that wars do happen, and the soldiers themselves should be protected when they shouldn't be mistreated and those sort of things.
I mean, you've got a difference, obviously, between soldiers and civilians. One of the figures that came out from the two American universities last week was this figure of 98% of people killed by drones are actually innocent in Pakistan, completely not involved in terrorism, not even suspected. So there's two things here. One is that lots of people who we know are innocent are being killed. Yeah. The second thing is people who are just simply terrorist suspects are being killed. So, I mean, that's on the civilian side. And the suspects on the military side. So how does the sort of the law that was, you know, used in the wars in the last century, like the Second World War, etc., which meant that once you'd surrendered, you had to be looked after by the enemy, and that civilians couldn't be killed by soldiers, or at least that there should be some effort to maintain to protect civilians. How does that all translate into this click and kill culture?
Well, it's quite difficult, because obviously if you believe that in your ethical stance, or whoever you are, is that wars at times are justifiable, you may need to, a country, a person may need to defend themselves, then and then it, whether to kill, to use a piece of equipment like a drone, which doesn't have a person directly behind operating it, sort of as it's in the sky, as it were, is that whether it's illegal or some, it's a very grey area, and one of the important aspects is that it makes wars more easier to happen.
It almost seems as if we may be moving to the position where, you know, if people start to be prosecuted for killing people using a drone, you know, remotely, then what they'll do is they'll just hand over those decisions to a computer somewhere, and maybe the Corsham Computer Centre here in Wiltshire, in between here and you know, the box tunnel under there somewhere, there's loads of NATO computers. That they will be given the task of assigning targets and actually controlling drone strikes. I mean, we're moving into quite a surreal world where actually the people being killed could move completely out of control.
I think you're right, Tony. Some of the scenarios are quite frightening, really. Yes. President Obama has, he meets fortnightly with the people who present who's going to be shot by using drones, and they present information to him, and that's what you're right in saying, well, maybe the people who operate them will dispense with that and just use tracking devices. And they do, there is an element of whether they decide an insurgent or an enemy is somebody who looks like one, so you get this vast and now this further reporting has revealed there is an even higher percentage of civilians killed than even some of the more skeptical observers in places like Pakistan have been saying.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hate to be cynical about this, but you could almost see someone programming into the big computer down at Caution, well, I'll tell you what, just program it to kill anyone you see with a beard. I mean, it's getting that crazy. So,
well, you can
anyway.
follow car registration, so you'll think you're quite right. But it's again, you may have the situations where the, is he the South American guy, Mendez, was virtually, well, he was killed.
Jean-Charles de Menezes, in London.
Where in a heightened situation of where police are, or the authorities are getting very fearful, and they think they're justified in just killing somebody. I see that happening, yes.
But the argument, of course, is that actually drones can be very useful too. I mean, for example, for following criminals, crime fighting, this could be, I mean, certainly, you must agree that there is a really positive potential use for these drones too.
There is. I mean, Greenpeace use a couple for sighting whale hunting ships in the Pacific Ocean. They're used for geology things, firefighting when it's in wilderness areas. There are some very valid, useful civilian aspects. But actually, one thing to remember is there's vast sums of money in the development of drones, and most of it will be military. And I did a little bit of extrapolation of some of the figures, and it's only going to go up to about, at the most, it's been between 4 to 6% of, this is in 10 to 15 years time, will be civilian. So the money and their use will be for military purposes.
Okay, so what's the campaigning, what's been going on the campaign side to try and at least halt the spread of this technology? Number one, right across the world, into many places. Yemen, obviously, there's drone strikes going on there. The US is preparing to bring drones into North Africa at the moment. Is there any, what's the state of the campaign?
What we're trying to do is raise people's awareness, really, against all the other issues that are carrying on. We think it's important because this fact is going to make wars easier, and it is involving a lot of civilian deaths. People who could be our allies, really, especially wars that are in Pakistan, which technically there isn't a war going on in Pakistan, but there's many, many deaths. We had a demo outside a drone conference early on this year, but our main thing is to raise awareness. And the
What about Bristol? For example, there's a lot of high tech stuff goes on up Aztec West and Filton, the places like that. Do we have drone manufacturers or developers, designers, that kind of thing in the city?
Bristol has been a sort of major aerospace manufacturer for 100 years, and although the drones themselves that we're developing, the Watchkeeper program, those are going to be built near Leicester and stationed in Norfolk. But
who actually builds these things? Watch companies?
There's a few major General Dynamics do it, the American company. The Israelis have used them in their locale, as it were, for many, many years. And they've developed sort of a lot of the surveillance technology. So that sort of Elbit, who are well known. Company they've been doing the major. There's Thal, a French company, are doing the Watchkeeper program as a consortium. They're based in Bristol, have three offices. The BAE Systems are involved with it, as they see a lot of commercial potential in it. Although their drone is called Taranis, but we're not sure how far that's got off the ground yet, and whether they might abandon it and work with the French on developing another one at the moment.
Well, one of the things that bothers me is we keep hearing from the government, oh, we want to move into high-tech industries. This is obviously a high-tech industry that could be totally unethical and actually could get people involved in it, see them in war crimes trials. So that's not the kind of high technology we really want. Anyway, Bob, how do people get involved in the campaign here in Bristol? Where do you do? What's your public face?
Bristol Against the Arms Trade meets regularly. The best way of contacting us is on our blog site, which is a useful source of information in itself. And it's bristolagainstarmstrade.wordpress.com. For national drone campaign, the best And the best thing to use is dronecampaignnetwork.org.uk. And the week of action next week revolves around a national, or it's an international campaign that's going on for many decades about the militarisation of space. So satellites are a very important part of use of drones, as well as the drones themselves being up in the atmosphere.
Well, Bob Nichols from Bristol Against the Arms Race, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. We are a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, please get hold of us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week.
every year we get a gospel dance record as good as Sounds of Blackness's Optimistic or this one, Lisa Taylor's